cosmological constant, as I'm sure you all have, and why it's so horribly fine-tuned, and in particular, why modified gravity, does it actually say anything about the fine-tuning problem, or is it just shifting the fine-tuning around into other parameters and not really doing anything for you? So the talk sort of has three parts. In the first part, I'll just review the usual cosmological constant, in particular, why it's a problem that there's an enormously small number appearing in a theory. It's a problem you have to get used to. In the second part, I'll describe some modified gravity models that are out there, some four-dimensional models that have the potential to explain the cosmological constant that we see, the observed small acceleration of the universe, without a bare underlying cosmological constant, or alternatively, even in the presence of a large bare cosmological constant. And in particular, why these models generally don't say anything about the fine-tuning. They are almost always exactly as tuned as the original cosmological constant to begin with, or they are worse tuned. Okay, and then in the last part, I'll show you a model that's based on Gasp-Monnet gravity, which again doesn't solve the cosmological constant in the sense that it doesn't tell you why it's small. But by shifting the tunings around, you can actually shift them around into a way that makes the tuning technically natural. Is this? Oh, great. Excellent. Thank you. Okay, so yeah, I'll be particularly interested to get feedback about this because it's not immediately clear whether this is actually progress or whether it's just more smoke and mirrors of shifting tunings around. Okay. So with that, here is the data, which I'm sure you are all familiar with, from the Supernova Cosmology Project. So you look at supernova, the magnitude versus redshift relation, out to a redshift of about one or so. And these things are supposed to be more or less standard candles, and that's enough information to recover the expansion history of the universe directly out to a redshift of about one or so. And the blue blob is over here, not over here, so the decelerating universe is pretty much ruled out. So what does this mean? It basically means that Einstein's equations, as we naively read them, are wrong. If we plug the observed expansion history into the left-hand side, then we put all the energy momentum that we see in the universe, all the matter, all the stars, all the dark matter, all the photons and whatnot, we stick it over here. The two are not equal. So you have to do something. But in fact, Einstein's equations are very flexible. It's very easy to fix. It's just not predictive when you don't know what the energy momentum in the universe is. The Einstein's equations tell you nothing. Or said another way, any metric is a solution to Einstein's equations. You stick the metric into the left-hand side. Whatever pops out the right-hand side, you declare that to be the energy momentum in the universe, and you're done. You've successfully modified gravity to account for whatever metric you have. So if we do this for the observed expansion history that we see, the modification can be accounted for with the deficiency in stress tensor can be accounted for by something which is just proportional to the metric. And we declare that we've discovered the mysterious dark energy. However, if you're really clever and on top of things, you don't have to modify left-hand or the right-hand side. You can modify the left-hand side of the equation. You move it over to the other side, and now you're smarter than Einstein because you're fixing his faulty theory of gravity, and you're working in the theory in the field of modified gravity.
So, I did the same thing.
That's true, but he didn't know how. True, yes. Okay, so of course, this is silly. Both modifications are just another term appearing in the Lagrangian, whether you call it part of the matter Lagrangian or part of the metric Lagrangian is up to you.
Didn't Einstein and Schrodinger actually have a big argument about which side of the equation they're going?
Did they? I didn't know that.
They wrote nasty letters to each other.
Really? Who?
Having nasty letters.
did Schrodinger, which side did Schrodinger want it on?
I don't know.
Okay. That's funny. Yeah, because Einstein was never too worried about the whole Lagrangian formulation at all. That was Hilbert. He actually, though, stumbled across the, this Lagrangian is sort of weird in that R has higher derivatives of the metric sitting in there. Even though the equations of motion are still second order, those higher derivatives only appear as a total derivative. And Einstein actually used this gamma-gamma form of the Lagrangian, which basically is taking away those higher derivatives. And so it doesn't look covariant at all. I mean, it is. It still has all the same symmetries and everything, but just doesn't look it. And then Hilbert came up with this nicer covariant form. But actually, the original gamma-gamma form is the one you need, because you know that there's a boundary term you have to add, this trace of k onto the boundary, which has the effect of taking away the higher derivatives, getting you back to that original Einstein form. So Einstein got it right, you know, 60 years before Gibbons and Hawking came up with their boundary term. Okay, so, but it's even easier to fix. Like, suppose the supernova data had indicated that the expansion was some crazy function, a of t, any function you can think of. You could have come up with a modification with just a minimally coupled scalar field with the right potential to account for whatever that function may have been. You can work backwards. It's curve fitting with a curve, really. If you have some arbitrary function a of t, you can put a v of phi in your minimally coupled scalar field and completely account for whatever data you may have. So the point is that the issue is not, can you fix gravity to account for the data? That's easy. The point is the modification plausible in any sense that you can trust an extrapolation of it? Because there are many modifications that work to account for all the data, but they have different extrapolations away from the data, so you need some sort of plausibility argument for why the one you have is to be trusted. Okay, so let's look at this simple modification of just adding the vacuum energy. We write it as rho vac. So this is the energy density that'll be associated with that parameter. So we have a Lagrangian with two parameters, Planck mass and the vacuum density. Both can be independently measured. They're both dimensionful, so really there's only one dimensionless parameter in this model, the ratio of the two energy scales, which is this huge number, 10 to the 122. So we have to decide, is it a problem that in a fundamental theory we have a huge number like this? And this is definitely a problem you have to, you know, have lots of years of schooling to appreciate. If you give somebody, you know, give like your undergraduate class or whatever a theory with a small parameter, they won't think twice. They'll be worried about the mathematical consistency of the theory or whether everything hangs together, but large numbers, not, you know, what's the problem? There are reasons why we think this is bad. Like, we have this idea that the theory of everything is some great theory out there in the clouds that has no free parameters whatsoever, sort of like string theory. And then we can imagine trying to calculate our low energy theory, this thing, from that theory with no free parameters, and we should be able to do some sort of, you know, matching calculation to calculate these things. And it's just hard to imagine that from a theory with no parameters, you can get this number 10 to the 120 from such a calculation. Because when we do matching calculations of the ones we're used to, the biggest numbers we ever see are like 4 pi squared coming from loop factors or something like that. But on the other hand, like the very fact that we don't know what the fundamental degrees of freedom of the universe are seems naively to indicate that things are very fine-tuned. Like, if you imagine a ferromagnet, which is just a bunch of spins, there's some critical temperature. Much below that critical temperature, nothing is happening. All the spins are just aligned. Above that critical temperature, everything's just going crazy. The interesting stuff is all happening at the scales of the individual spins. It's only when you're fine-tuning the temperature to be very near the critical temperature that you have interesting fluctuations and interesting phenomena going on scales much larger than the scales of the spins. So we are all fluctuations going on scales much larger than the fundamental degrees of freedom of the universe, simply by the fact that we don't know what those degrees of freedom are, which means that it seems to suggest that there's some fine-tuning there. You know, and we know there's fine-tuning all around, like the distance from the Earth to the Sun is fine-tuned to be right for life. And we know there that the correct answer to why that's the case is, in fact, anthropic. Okay, so, but here's a more, you know, down-to-earth argument for why we think the vacuum energy should be large. Suppose this theory is the theory of everything. We have our ordinary Einstein gravity with some bare cosmological constant. And then up at high energies, there's this massive scalar field. So M here, big M, is the mass of the scalar field. We imagine this is at some high energy much higher than us. To get what our theory is that we're using down at low energies, we should integrate out the scalar. Here's a what you get when you integrate out that scalar. You find that the effective cosmological constant is this whole contribution here. So it's the bare cosmological constant plus this term proportional to the fourth power of the mass of the scalar and then logarithmic corrections. The mu here is the renormalization scale at which you're doing your low energy experiments. So to get a small effective cosmological constant, it's not enough to explain why the bare cosmological constant is small. It's not enough to come up with some fancy mechanism that explains why you have a small cosmological constant, because it's really it's a balance between the bare cosmological constant and these quantum corrections. These have to finally cancel to give a small effective cosmological constant. So whatever fancy mechanism you think of has to know about the quantum corrections to affect this cancellation. And
yeah. Before that, you're showing the cutoff, no?
Sorry, where?
Well, the basic cosmological constant, that's probably the most dangerous term because it depends on the mass of the stars, etc. But in principle, you also have cutoff to the fourth power, etc.
You mean if there's other degrees of freedom being integrated out?
The result is infinite, right? So you need.
Well, yeah, I mean, there are no infinities in quantum field theory anyway. But this is a matching calculation. We're matching onto some. We're matching this low energy theory onto the predictions of this theory. And the scale at which we're matching in this case is scale m of the.
So you have infinity since you roll back, is that interesting?
Yeah, I think it's misleading. Like even in ordinary quantum field theory, it's misleading to think that there are infinities there. It's really you're setting the theory, you're renormalizing the theory to some scale. Like when you're doing dimensional regularization or something, there's no, the infinities appear as 1/ε poles. They're not even energies.
Are you doing dimensional regularization?
This is done. Yeah, this is done in dimensional regularization with minimal subtraction.
This is the Wilsonian complex. This is the Wilsonian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Which is
new squared is your scale of observation.
That's right.
So that brings you back down into reality, into renormalized scale.
Yeah, that's right. But there's no infinities anywhere here.
I just thought there's a cutoff dependence.
Where is mu to the fourth? Shouldn't there be a mu to the fourth term?
A mu to the fourth term? No, the mu's in dimensional regularization only appear within logarithms. Yeah. And you see you also get corrections to the Planck mass, but those are of the same order or much smaller than the original Planck mass to begin with, so it's not nearly as dangerous. And you get sort of an infinite slew of all possible higher curvature scalars. So those are all going to be suppressed by this higher mass scale, so they basically are unobservable. Okay, so if you want to have some fancy classical mechanism that explains why this thing is slow and then be able to trust that the quantum corrections don't ruin it, this is why we insist on technical naturalness of parameters and why we like symmetries. So suppose that there's some symmetry out there that ensures that the cosmological constant just vanishes identically. So the only known symmetries that can do this, like conformal symmetry and supersymmetry, are badly broken at our energy scale, so they can't really do this. But just suppose that there's some symmetry that can assure this, then quantum corrections will also vanish if they respect this symmetry. Now imagine that we add some term that is multiplying a small parameter that breaks the symmetry. The quantum corrections now have to be proportional to this small symmetry breaking parameter. And now, because everything has this small parameter in it, it's possible that the quantum corrections won't ruin the smallness that you had to begin with. So if you can come up with some mechanism that explains why the vacuum energy is small to begin with, and you demand this technical naturalness, that would be a legitimate solution to the cosmological constant problem. Okay, so what I'm going to try and do in the model that I'll tell you about later is to get this technical naturalness. It won't explain why the parameter is small to begin with, but it will at least be, the smallness will at least be technically natural. Okay, so now let me go on to the second part and just go over some modified gravity models that are out there, just staying in four dimensions to start with. So modified gravity just means, you know, change the Lagrangian, make it, for instance, a function of all these higher curvature invariants or whatever you want. Here's sort of the decisions you have to make when you're modifying gravity. You don't want to stay in four dimensions, you're led down the whole compactification brain world line of thought. If you do want to stay in four dimensions, you have to decide whether you want to break diffeomorphism invariance or not, which basically means introducing a background field or not. If you do, you're led down massive gravity. Those have background fields, or ether theories, or things like that. And these things usually suffer from the pathology that they have a very low UV cutoff, much lower than the Planck mass. So they're not very good as effective field theories. So generally, you want to keep diffeomorphism invariance. And then you're almost invariably led to some sort of scalar tensor theory, or tensor vector theory, or something like that. And this chart isn't completely, the bifurcation isn't complete, because even higher dimensional theory will always have some sort of four-dimensional description, which will end up looking like some sort of scalar tensor theory, maybe with resonances or something like that. OK, so here's the simplest sort of modification, f of r gravity, where you change the action to be an arbitrary function of the Ricci scalar r. And you don't allow any of the higher curvature invariants to appear. So now, because R does have second derivatives of the metric buried in there, it's legitimately, and they don't appear as total derivatives any longer, it's a legitimately higher order Lagrangian, and you get fourth order equations of motion. The symmetry group hasn't changed at all. Still, diffeomorphism invariance is your only symmetry. So it means that you have more degrees of freedom buried in those higher derivatives. The best way to tease out those degrees of freedom is to show that this thing is actually equivalent to a plain old scalar tensor theory. So this is well known. You take, you write down this action, which is essentially just Brands-Dickey theory with no scalar kinetic term, so omega equals zero, but a potential for the scalar field. If you look at the scalar equations of motion, you can solve them algebraically, and it tells you that phi, the scalar field, is just the curvature. So it's an auxiliary field, and if you plug back in to this action, you recover the f of r action, so the two are classically equivalent. If you want, you can make a conformal change of variables and bring this thing to completely canonical scalar tensor form, where you have some complicated potential that's going to depend on what that f was. And then matter will now be non-minimally coupled. OK, so here is something that illustrates that basically any type of adding higher curvature terms like this, you always end up getting some sort of scalar tensor theory at the end if you want to avoid pathology. So here's a more complicated example where we allow the Lagrangian to be an arbitrary function of any of these quadratic higher order curvature invariants. So if you introduce now four scalar fields, auxiliary scalar fields, one for each of these curvature invariants to bring it to an f of r form, and then another one to bring that f of r form back to a scalar tensor theory, you, in the end, get this mess. So you get this particular combination in front of r, so that's the Brands-Dickey part. This tells you that only one of these four scalar field theories, so phi 1 through phi 4 are the scalar fields. F1, F2 just means derivative f with respect to the first, second argument, etc., and evaluated at the particular scalar fields that you're using to substitute here. So there's one combination here of the scalar fields that is dynamical, and the other three are non-dynamical. They're still auxiliary fields. You do get something new here. This term here, proportional to the Weyl tensor squared, will give you, in general, a spin 2 ghost field. So if you want to be free of ghosts, you have to demand that this coefficient vanish. So that puts a condition on this function f. This combination you get here will appear later. This is the Gauss-Bonnet invariant. It's a total derivative. It actually doesn't add any new degrees of freedom to this model. And then you get a complicated potential for the scalar. But so in the end, if you demand that this term vanish so that there's no ghosts, this whole complicated Lagrangian is just scalar tensor theory again, single scalar field.
So the Gauss-Bonnet term is a total derivative if it doesn't have a scalar feedback, but it does have a scalar feedback.
That's right, but it still doesn't give any higher than second order equations of motion, even with the scalar prefactor.
Is it still a scalar tensor theory?
Yes.
Why? Because the scalar tensor theory doesn't have a scalar
effect. That's right, but it's still, all it's doing is modifying the dynamics of the scalar tensor theory. It's not adding new degrees of freedom. So right, you can't rewrite it as a traditional scalar tensor theory. So it is modifying the dynamic. Okay, so here's a model, an f of r model that allows you to get a small acceleration for the universe without a cosmological constant. This is the CDTT model. So you take this f of r, which is like an r plus 1 over r Lagrangian. This is the usual Planck length. This mu here is a new parameter with dimensions of mass. And you find that there's a vacuum solution to this where the curvature scalar is set by this mu. So if you choose mu to be very small, you can get an accelerating universe without a vacuum energy. But it's the exact same fine-tuning you have to make of just putting a bare cosmological constant. This mu compared with kappa has to be just as tuned. If you look at the equivalent scalar tensor theory, this is what the potential looks like, this sort of shape here. And the vacuum solution is right here on the top. So it's unstable. It's a tachyon. This is what the potential looks like expanded around that top point. So though you get a constant term, which is the cosmological constant, and it's finely tuned, just as if you had a bare cosmological constant to begin with. And you have this negative mass square term, so this thing's a tachyon. But you don't really have to worry about it because the instability, the time scale of instability of this thing is mu. So it's only unstable on cosmological timescales. So you can get away with having it. The higher interactions are all suppressed by higher powers of the Planck length. So as an effective field theory, this thing is valid all the way up to the Planck length. There's no strong coupling that sets in. So it really does nothing for the actual cosmological constant problem, just as finely tuned. All it does is sort of make you feel better by not having a bare underlying cosmological constant to begin with. Okay, so here I want to show you a model that we can think of as a sort of UV completion of that CDTT model. It's not really a UV completion because we're not integrating out a degree of freedom. It has the same number of degrees of freedom, but it's, think of it as like a UV alteration or something. So we have a usual Einstein-Hilbert term with a bare Planck mass, ordinary scalar kinetic term. The scalar potential is linear here. So we're going to allow there to be a large Planck scale underlying vacuum energy, and then a linear coupling to phi, to a source. So if you want, we're going to imagine that this source J is naturally small. So you can say it's like a QCD condensate of some sort or something like that it's coupling to. But really, it's just another parameter in the theory that we want to be small. And then there's going to be this non-minimal coupling here, proportional to this dimensionless parameter C. And the thing to notice is that if C is 0, then the vacuum energy here is actually not observable. It's a redundant coupling. You can redefine phi by shifting it and eliminate the cosmological constant if you want. It's only this C that eliminates that redundancy. If you look at...
Sorry, are you talking about gravity or just the dynamics of phi? Because gravity, C0 vacuum.
Even with gravity, though, C is a redundant coupling when C is 0. So if you do a field redefinition of psi, you're going to it also has that root G and everything, so it's absorbed the cosmological. Okay, so if we solve for the scalar VEV and plug back in, we get this model, which is the DTT model from before, the R plus 1 over R form, where that scale mu now is set by this J. And then this bare underlying cosmological constant comes for the ride. Okay, so something interesting happens when you add a large bare cosmological constant to this CDTT model. Instead of just the one low curvature solution that we had before, we now get two different solutions. There's going to be one solution which has a very high curvature, a Planck scale curvature, which is basically comes from this term, the Einstein-Hilbert term dominating. There's also going to be another low curvature solution, which is set by J and comes from this 1 over R term dominating. So it's sort of like a seesaw effect going on, where you have two solutions. One is high curvature, one is low curvature. So, you know, we could imagine that we live in this low curvature solution, and it exists despite the fact that there's a large bare underlying cosmological constant. Okay, so there's several comments about this and problems with this that we'll try and resolve in a later model. So first of all, the scalar VEV here is going to be enormous. So we imagine that J was sort of reasonable valued on scale of particle physics. R is the Hubble scale. It's very small. So this VEV of phi is going to be enormous beyond Planck scale. So you just can't trust it as an effective field theory unless you imagine that the potential for phi is flat out to very high order. A more serious problem is that the Planck mass is actually shifted. So if you look back at the Lagrangian here, if you plug in the VEV for phi, there's going to be a constant piece here that goes along with this and contributes to shifting the Planck mass. So the effective Planck mass that we see is given by this combination. So this thing was huge. So it means that the bare Planck mass has to be finely tuned to cancel this huge VEV that we have to give the observed effective Planck mass, which is another fine tuning that's going to have to be made, which is not good. So once you do this, the way this model works is basically this VEV here cancels off the bare vacuum energy to give you a small observed vacuum energy. And if you rewrite the equations of motion for the vacuum in terms of all the observed quantities, you see that it's the ordinary Friedman equation. Sorry.
Is that part of the cancellation?
Yeah, that's, well, it's going to give you this here, right?
In your later statement, that the vacuum energy gets canceled by stuff.
Right? Oh.
What I do is I take the classical solution, I plug it into the action, and then
sorry,
all
yeah.
the terms are there canceled.
Yeah, so plugging the VEV into here is going to give you a constant piece.
That,
There's no constant piece that comes out of there, though.
Well, I'm not worried about whether it's constant, whether it's big.
So I'm not sure what you're worried about.
The cancellation statement is that if I take phi equals this constant, I plug into the action, then all the terms independent of R are canceled.
Oh, no. That's not the statement. Just
well,
that.
What is the statement?
Just that the term that is independent is small.
And for the other terms?
The other terms are still there, yeah.
Vacuum is small?
Yeah.
Why?
The effective rho vacuum is small.
And my worry was that if R was a constant, say it was h squared, then is the R phi squared term small or large? In case anything as large as it can.
Not quite sure what the worry is.
Oh,
let's see. Yeah, no. I'm not quite sure what you're worried about because it's only the constant part that's going to be the effective rho vac that we're.
It's kind of what's a constant at some level. if R is a constant,
mm-hmm. R is not
well,
a constant.
R is not.
If I change it up, so then I guess I should see where you're going to go.
Okay.
So the part I didn't understand why.
This, I mean, you can just forget about the whole Lagrangian. There is a solution of this action where the curvature scale is this small number.
I don't know where that solution came from in your actually thinking of being potential. It seemed like it wouldn't be such a big stretch to say if I took R to be roughly a constant, I thought I would consider my solution. I just thought about what's balance I want to make the minimum be small.
Oh.
Just in terms of C equals to 1, all I have.
Okay, yeah, it is it's that R squared term that's dominating over the Einstein-Hilbert term that makes this thing small. So, yeah.
So on the previous page,
mm-hmm.
So you said let's integrate out the scalar field, and then we see if there are two solutions, high curvature and low curvature. And you might think that, look, I'm doing effective field theory now, and I know that high curvature probably won't make sense, so I'm going to do the low curvature. But I mean, is there any other reason why there's some discrimination between those solutions? I mean, is the low curvature one like clearly have a much smaller action than the high curvature?
You mean why it should be preferred in some some sense?
Yeah, is there any reason
No, not really. In fact, it's worse than that in this model, in that the high curvature solution is unstable and the low curvature solution is stable. So it's exactly sort of backwards from what you would want. So let me just make some comments about this. So we want the low curvature solution to be stable, the high curvature to be unstable. Under control with respect to what?
Well, you made an approximation of
Not really. We didn't. I mean, you don't. You can just think of this, we're solving for the vacua. We're not really concerned about any effective field theory. We haven't done any approximation to solve for these vacua.
Well, it's actually
a
classical approximation.
Yeah, sure. Right. And in fact, these things are not stable under this is not the model to get interested in. These things are not stable under radiative corrections in any sense. So the one I'll show you later is stable under radiative corrections, where we can trust these solutions.
Yes,
this is not a good model. Don't get too excited. Okay, so basically this is worse tuned than the original cosmological constant problem, which I'll show you later. It's twice as badly tuned. You have to tune. There's two parameters here, small parameters in the model. I'll show you. Also, the stability is wrong. Low curvature solution we have is unstable. The high curvature solution is stable. So you tend to go backwards from what you would want to. You can fix this if you want. There are FOR theories you can think of where you have a high curvature solution, which is unstable, and then a low curvature solution, which is stable. So you can imagine starting in this high curvature solution and having inflation and then rolling down into the low curvature solution. But again, the tunings that you have to make to accomplish this are not technically natural in any sense. In the R phi squared model here? It looks something like this. So you have the solution that's interesting is up here, an unstable high curvature solution is there.
So why does it time us for instability?
You can make it whatever you want by adjusting this parameter C. So it's unstable. To make it stable on cosmological timescales, you actually have to do another tuning. You have to make C this extraordinarily small number. And again, there are large VEVs, and it's unstable under radiative corrections. Here's the two parameters that you have to tune in this model. So remember, the bare Planck mass was not the same as the effective Planck mass. So to get the right effective Planck mass is one tuning, and to get the vacuum energy to be small compared to to get the effective vacuum energy small compared to the bare vacuum energy is a second tuning. And they're both of order the tuning you have to do for the original cosmological constant. So here's a sort of more general perspective that shows that this generically is what you're going to have to do if you're working just in scalar tensor theory in four dimensions. So here's a sort of generic scalar tensor theory with an arbitrary non-minimal coupling to R and an arbitrary potential and a kinetic term. There are two equations of motion that tell you what the vacua are. One equation for the scalar field VEV and the other for the what the curvature of the constant curvature solution is. The effective vacuum energy that we see is just the expectation value of the potential. The effective Planck mass we see is going to be the expectation value of the stuff multiplying R. Okay, so we can in fact build models with the right effective Planck mass and the right effective cosmological constant in the following way. We can take an F of R action, here I guess I called it L of R, and then sort of go backwards to put back in the scalar field, you know, unintegrated. That amounts to just doing a Legendre transformation. Introduce some dimensionless parameters here. So Y, just think of as the curvature scalar in units of the effective Planck mass. The Lagrangian will be a function now, F of Y. And then epsilon, think of as the small parameter, which is the constant curvature solution we want in units of the effective Planck mass. So this is the 10 to the minus 120 that we're going to need to explain the acceleration of the universe. All this boils down to is that if you satisfy these two conditions for any F, you can make a Lagrangian that has the right effective Planck mass. That's what this condition will guarantee for you, and the right low curvature solution. That's what this condition will guarantee for you. So any function you can think of with these two conditions gives you a scalar tensor theory that explains, that has the right solution. So here are some examples of functions. There's, of course, an infinite number. Some of these are kind of strange, like here's log of R gravity or root 1 plus 2 R squared gravity. If you want to be more systematic, expand in a Taylor series in R. And now those conditions become conditions on the coefficients.
So these are, so you have an imposed condition as W is minus 1.
That's right. That will be an additional constraint. Exactly right. And an additional tuning as well to achieve that. Okay. No, this will guarantee that one solution is like that, but there may be others as well. So here's some examples. Here's the simplest case where you just choose the F to be a linear function. This is ordinary Einstein gravity with a cosmological constant. Here's an example that illustrates what you're asking about, where we take R squared to be the Lagrangian. If you put back in the scalar field, you get this thing here. This thing is actually scale invariant under a constant scaling of the metric and a simultaneous scaling of the scalar field. So this has solutions for any value, any positive curvature, and any positive VEV of the scalar field. So in addition to the solution you want, it also has an infinite number of other ones. Here's a choice that reproduces the R phi squared model I showed you before. That had it had the solution we want, but it also has an additional high curvature solution. This one's kind of interesting. If you choose the parameters in this way, you get this Lagrangian, which is like 1 over R plus 1 over R squared. So this shows that to get the right acceleration of the universe and Planck mass, you don't even need an Einstein-Hilbert term.
What was the Lagrangian?
this thing here, like 1 over r, 1 over r squared.
So all these models are equivalent to some scalar.
That's right. Yep, they are all. I mean, any f of r is equivalent to a scalar tensor. Basically, all modified gravity is scalar tensor theory in some guise or another. Okay, so there are two fine tunings that we have to make here. To get the right low curvature solution, this condition in of itself is a fine tuning. So we have some function f of r, and we're demanding, this epsilon here is very small, so we're demanding that that function go very close to the origin. That's, most functions don't go very close to the origin. That's a fine tuning. If it goes close to the origin, as you pass y equals 0, it should still be near the origin generically. If we want there to be a large, bare Planck mass cosmological constant, that's like saying that we want f to have an order 1 piece to it in the Taylor expansion. So that's saying that f of 0 actually has to be order 1 as opposed to epsilon. So it's another fine tuning to make a low curvature solution in the presence of a bare underlying cosmological constant that's large. So the function has to go very close to the origin, and then it has to jet down to minus 1, and that's in general a second tuning. And again, these tunings are not technically natural generically in any sense. OK, so here, now I want to introduce a model that gets around.
Can you remind me what you mean by technically natural?
In the sense that radiative corrections don't destabilize the vacuum solution.
Radiative corrections of a scalar or a
So it's a scalar potential that you don't want to be messy. That's what I'm going to tell you. Your vacuum solution. Okay, so to start to introduce this model here, I want to review what these special Lovelock terms are. So these are various combinations of the higher order combinations of the curvature invariants that have nice properties. There's one for each there. There's an infinite number of them in each power of the curvature. L0 is just a constant, the cosmological constant. L1 is R, the Einstein-Hilbert term. L2 is this combination which we'll make use of, called the Gauss-Bonnet invariant. So you can think of these as like generalizations of the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian to higher dimensions. They're, in fact, the only modifications you can make of Einstein gravity in higher dimensions that don't introduce additional degrees of freedom.
There are other topological invariants as you go higher, right? For instance, quadratic in the curvature, you have the Gauss-Bonnet term, but you also have what's called the Hertzsprung signature, which is like taking two copies of Riemann with a couple indices contracted and the rest contracted with the epsilon tensor. That's where they get this, what they call Chern-Simons gravity.
So at
any order, the number of topological terms increases.
Okay, but these things are supposed to be the unique things that give you second order equations of motion.
No, I think any scalar times what would have been a topological, the times a topological density.
Will give you second order equations of motion?
Yeah, I know. I know that other quadratic one, though.
The Chern-Simons.
Okay, and you say there's an epsilon tensor in there, so is it. Maybe there's another condition like on parity that can't be violated or something.
That is true. I mean, this would be. I think that would be parity violating.
Yeah,
it's basically RR stuff.
Okay, but yeah, I'll look into it. But what I thought is that these are the only terms you can add that have the property that they give you second order equations of motion when you put them in other dimensions. So if you take the second order Gauss-Bonnet invariant and put it in 10 dimensions, for instance, it still gives you second order equations of motion. Is that true of the other one?
Okay.
Okay, but in any case, this works, and this is a topological invariant. Gives you the Euler number if you integrate it over its home dimension. It also gives you second order equations of motion if you multiply by scalars. So you can use this thing in four dimensions. You can multiply it by a scalar field, and the resulting equations of motion will still be second order. And these things are also supposed to come from alpha prime corrections of string theory. So the alpha prime corrections come with these higher powers of the curvature invariant. And they won't always look directly like this, but there's an ambiguity because these things are coming from a string S matrix, which is only defined on shell. So you can redefine fields in such a way that you can always bring the corrections into these combinations.
With alpha prime corrections, because they're an effective field theory, there's no requirement that they have to reproduce only second order equations.
That's right. If they weren't second order, you would just not care because those are, the scale of masses of those extra degrees of freedom should be beyond alpha prime anyway.
What's the symmetry reason for you get other things as well. You do. Saying you could write corrections as something like that, and plus some other terms, maybe focus on these.
You can bring them into this form if you want. I mean, there's other fields and stuff. Yeah.
It's not relevant for low energy.
Right. If you're interested in curvature square corrections, then there are kind of three independent ones, and you can use any basis for those you want. So use this as one of the terms in your basis, and then you have one take like bound squared, and then there would be like R squared or something like that, and you say you're getting into that. And on top of that, you've got freedom to use the crazy function simplify, so almost always you can take the root tensor and replace it by the field. So if you're just talking about curvature squared, you can probably make it 3 months squared plus thing.
Yeah. I think with pure gravity, you can completely get rid of the second order curvatures if you want. And then you get sort of complicated interactions of the stress tensor as a price. But. OK, so here's a model, which we'll call the Gauss-Bonnet model, which is patterned after that R phi squared model. But instead of coupling to R phi squared, we couple to this Gauss-Bonnet invariant because the total derivative property is going to come in very usefully. So again, we imagine that this is a Planck mass underlying that cosmological constant, and this J is small in some is just naturally small in some way. Okay. Again, we have two types of solutions. We actually get three solutions now because of the term is now second power in the curvatures. We get two solutions with low curvature, one of which is positive, and one, again, high curvature solution set by the Planck mass. And this is the one tuning we're going to have to make that's equivalent to tuning the original cosmological constant. There will be another tuning of C. We're going to have to make C very small as well. But that will be these two tunings will then be technically natural in the sense that huge radiative corrections to the cosmological constant won't screw things up. OK. The first place where this total derivative thing comes in nice is that the bare Planck mass is not shifted at all. When we expand phi here around its VEV, the constant piece is just a total derivative. So it doesn't shift the bare Planck mass at all. So that it eliminates that tuning that we had to make in the R phi squared model. So we're left with this one parameter that we have to make small if we want to give the right acceleration of the universe in the low curvature solution. And it's the same tuning we would have to make for a bare cosmological constant. Again, here, that solution is unstable. There's no natural way we can say that we're supposed to have evolved there or something, apart from saying that like in the early universe, thermal fluctuations should generically set you down in sort of a maximum of a potential or something like that. But it is unstable. And we still have these large VEVs. And you can also make this thing pass solar system tests if you make C small, which we're going to have to do anyway for the quantum corrections. Okay. Okay, so let's just look at the quantum corrections to this. So we expand the fields around its VEV. These are the sort of vertices we get. We get vertices coupling a single phi to any number of gravitons, and then a vertex coupling two phis to two or more gravitons. There's a if you set C and J to zero, there's a shift symmetry of the field. So all the quantum corrections have to be proportional to those parameters. There are no vertices coming from that J term. All the let's say we're looking at corrections to the scalar field mass, just to be specific. There's going to be no vertices coming from this J term. That cancels against the Gauss-Bonnet term when you expand around this VEV. So all the corrections have to be proportional to this parameter C. But that's still not enough to say that we can trust our vacuum solution. But suppose that the cutoff, the UV cutoff here, is the Planck mass. If we had a correction to the mass like this, it would ruin the condition that we had, that the scalar mass be much less than what's in front of that Gauss-Bonnet term. This is the condition we need to preserve the solution, the smallness of the solution we're interested in. So if this were the case, it would mean that this thing is unstable to quantum correction. Okay, so but in fact, this Gauss-Bonnet total derivative thing is going to come to the rescue again. Because here are the first corrections to the scalar mass that you might expect to be dangerous. The crucial point about that vertex is that if all the momentum coming in on all the scalar field lines is zero, then the vertex vanishes because the rest of the vertex is a total derivative. So these terms actually, these graphs all vanish at zero external momentum, so they don't contribute to the scalar field mass at all.
But the loops preserve the relative size of the terms in V.
The relative size of which?
In fact, you have exactly Gauss-Bonnet times the function phi.
Uh-huh.
You can normalize the whole boundary layer against scales, but I get relative normalizations of the R squared and the H squared.
Yeah, because there's no new degrees of freedom coming in from that. So well, I guess you could get, sorry, no, it wouldn't generically preserve that form, but any sort of new corrections you get should be negligible compared to these sort of corrections.
It sounds like that might be where your nationalist issue is hidden, because if you're asking whatever's nicely Lagrangian, why the statement of normalization, mm-hmm. what's nicely your Lagrangian seems to be relying on the structure of G. So the question would be, is that stable?
Yeah, that's right. No, those other sort of curvature invariants that you can have, they're not. It's not going to mess with the vacuum solution that we have. It's not going to change the order of magnitude of the vacuum solution. I agree that these nice properties won't be preserved. But
the first loop changes G, and the second loop then nails you on the scalar correction to the mass of the vacuum.
But you're not going to be using those second loops to calculate corrections to the scalar field mass, right? You should only be pulling the vertices from the original Lagrangian.
You're saying if you arrange for something that has very, very small corrections, so if I remove the delicateness of the cancellation that made the correction small, your air corrections can only be huge, even if the anomaly is down by some number of loops.
Yeah, no, I don't think that's the problem, right? Oh, okay.
Generically, what happens is that if it's not enforced by symmetry, it's always ruined by some order.
Yeah, well, this is sort of enforced by a sort of pseudo. I mean, if that parameter C is zero.
If I'm not worried about that, I'm worried about the relative terms inside G. So I really should have done it for effective theory. We could write down all plus the things with that many derivatives. And I wouldn't have been required to require just the specific combination that you wrote down.
That's right. But you're not required to write those down to begin with. Right? It's
some order of derivative expansion. And once you've said you want to work to curvature squared.
Right. If we have some high energy theory in mind that we're trying to match to, then yes, we have to write down everything. And then we have to match the coefficients or whatever. And we should include everything. But if there's no such high energy theory in mind, then you're sort of free to leave out terms that you want, right?
Zero, but then the question is, is that a normalization group in the current state?
Right, yeah, no.
Run down to some other scalar, it's still there.
Right, yeah, no, I guess it's not, but it's But that's not going to ruin the size of the vacuum that we have.
Why don't you see that? Because the thing is, the loop corrections want to be the biggest mass in the problem. Mm-hmm. You're saving that because you've got a very, very special coupling to the only loops that are allowing people around. If I started with not going around, but a slightly different one where I didn't have exactly those pain, then I think if I would have a non-zero contribution from these graphs, proportional to these small deviations from those pain.
Yeah, I guess I'm confused because we're not going to be drawing loops from, we're not going to be drawing vertices from these new contributions, right? I mean, you have to draw vertices from the original Brongian that you started with. Suppose we have a 5/4 theory or something, just Taylor field theory, and there's no mass term or whatever. You'd say, oh, that's not good because the 5/4 interaction is going to be generating a mass term. But there's no, I guess that's.
One way of saying the natural state you're trying to address with this, the scalar potential itself, would be that if I start off at zero for that mass, mm-hmm. and then I get a big thing that it has to renormalize something. So what happens is it's renormalizing the counter term that I didn't write down because I just renormalized by zero.
Yeah.
The fact that I'm getting this contribution shows you that if I then renormalize slightly differently, it's a different scale, I don't get zero. Right? So the statement of zero is a very special statement, but it's not a representation of the variance. So that wouldn't count as a natural solution because I could have done the same thing for the cosmological. If that's not what I'm allowed to do, I'll just say, well, let's choose the cosmological cosmological to zero at some point, which is what we normally do. That's called fine tuning.
Right, yeah. Okay, I need to. Yeah, but there is no such symmetry that I know of.
I don't know the loops actually do change.
I don't either. Yeah. Yeah, but it's not, I mean.
You have to be careful about using the argument that there are a finite number of vertices you have to consider because it's a non-normalizable theory. Mm-hmm. So you worry that you might always be generating new vertices.
That's right. But you only have to worry about vertices that are dimension lower than or equal to the one you started with. There are ones that are going to ruin that Gauss-Bonnet combination. Okay. Let me just finish this. Assuming that this is all there is, the first contribution will actually come in at two loops, and you can estimate its size. It comes out proportional to c squared. So to preserve this condition, you actually you need to make c about 10 to the minus 240. It's another, yeah, another. Yeah, that's 240. That's much worse. Okay. Okay. Yeah. So, but you know, modulo this thing that this will be a technically natural tuning. Yeah. And again, for corrections to the source, same sort of thing. You need a similar condition comes out. Right. That's what we're claiming. Okay, so the important thing, though, is that corrections to the vacuum energy are still going to be there. Those are still going to be quadratically divergent. So we're going to get like a Planck mass to the fourth correction shift to the bare, so an order one shift to the bare vacuum energy. But it's going to preserve, the tunings we made actually preserve that in the sense that the scalar field VEV will just adjust itself to soak up that renormalized vacuum energy and maintain a small effective cosmological. Okay.
Do you understand why that's true? The phi wants to adjust to make things small, but why does it want to be that?
Why does it want to be that? I mean, that's just the fact that that's where the solution is, the fact that it has these two solutions. It's sort of like a seesaw mechanism.
Possible solution to kind of whatever this little bit of a 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 little
So actually, this kind of thing, if you like a string landscape, you have to worry about that. These, you know, if there are mechanisms like this out there. So you know, imagine that there are you know, there's 10 to the 500 vacua or whatever, and 10 to the 100 of them maybe have a small bare cosmological constant, and that's why we see a small underlying cosmological constant or a small effective cosmological constant. But you know, what if 120, 10 to the 120 of these vacua realize a small effective cosmological constant by some other mechanism? Then those are going to dominate. You have to worry about them. Okay, so in conclusion, these F of R models, these four-dimensional modifications of gravity that we make, they can account for the dark energy. They can account for the small accelerated expansion, but they can't really say anything about the fine-tuning. You're almost always just shifting it around in some way. But we can, if we have freedom to push around the tuning, you know, it's makes sense that we might be able to push it around in such a way that it becomes technically natural. Okay, so future questions that we have are, of course, realizing an actual cosmological solution in this context. If we could find something within this, a Gauss-Bonnet-like model like this, where there's an unstable high curvature solution and a stable low curvature solution, and we get cosmological solutions that have inflation and go from one to the other, that would be more interesting. And of course, you embed this in string theory, people will take it more seriously. Yeah. Embed it in loop quantum gravity. Okay. Okay, so that's it. Thank you.
More questions? But I'd like to understand better. So how was this fact that the alpha prime correction only contain, so if this is true in string theory, then perhaps this is the mechanism that you need to preserve these. But then probably it's not even true in string theory. So I would like to understand better what's happening in string theory.
What is not? What
that
is true in string theory?
All the terms higher order in the curvature appear as Gauss-Bonnet.
Yeah.
Is it true or not?
It is true. Yeah, this is
true with the exception in the sense that if you look at the lowest, the first contribution you get with fewest temperatures, what's normally true is that there's a lot of ways you can rewrite it because you use the equation function.
Yeah.
And so that if you wrote the generic thing down, it can often look like it's Gauss-Bonnet just because you can rewrite it in a lot of interesting ways. So it's not evidence for any special property of string theory, the fact that it comes up that way.
I see.
Well, but so, I mean, but it didn't have to be true that. It's rewritable always in that combination.
I can't remember the strength operation if that was a miracle or not, but it's
I mean, I think it is somewhat miraculous that you can always write it in that particular combination. A generic higher derivative modification to gravity would not be writable in that combination always.
The solutions that you get, small curvatures, but I mean, are they kind of eternally?
I mean,
do they behave kind of like the sitter?
Yeah, I mean, the solutions we have here are just the sitter. It's saying nothing about the global structure, we haven't.
So the statements about the corrections, like you said, come from doing, you know, string S matrix calculations. But you're getting a space time that doesn't have an S matrix.
Yeah, well, I mean, how do you deal with that in string theory? People use the string effective actions that come from S matrix computations, and they compactify them. And same question should apply there, right?
So you don't get 10 like watt temperature square in a string theory.
But you do. You use divisional motion and.
There are lots of examples where you integrate out, you know, where you actually know what the net higher energy physics is. You integrate out metaphysics and you get lots of things which change the character of the low energy field theory so that it would have more equivalent runaway solutions. And there's no fundamental criterion saying that a sensible higher energy theory can't give you 20 negative lessons. You know, perfectly reasonable theories of high energies can give you lots of things at low energies which look like they're giving you runaway solutions.
Yeah.
The thing is that the low energy theories and the one over the heavy mass, and then the rabbi stations go like E to the MT or something that's very exponentially smaller than the heavy mass.
Yeah.
So that just, they're just spurious to the 1D3 and you don't believe it.
Yeah.
So there's just no criteria at all saying that 1D3 has to have these special form of dose training.
Yeah.
Just because it came from a sensible range.
Yeah, even E and M, if you integrate out the electron for the Euler, you get this Euler-Heisenberg Lagrangian, which has higher derivative interactions of, in the quadratic, or, yeah, that are quadratic in the photon. And so you might naively think that there's extra degrees of freedom in the theory or in ghosts or whatever, but all you know, you're not supposed to, you're not allowed to put that part of the propagator into. You're not allowed to resum those higher quadratic terms because they're going beyond the limits of the effective field theory.
More questions?